Today, I want to conclude the study on the five love languages, and I guess I actually really get into the study on the five love languages because last time, if you remember, I really covered what the Bible's prescription for how husbands and wives ought to love each other. And the way I reason it, I figure we ought to look at what God says primarily first and find out what He says about loving each other. And then we can look at what man says and see what man has to say about it. And if what man has to say about it is good, and if it's true, and if it's in accord with the scripture, and it's not against it, then good, we can learn from it. And we should. I'm not one of these guys that don't think we can ever read anybody secular and learn anything from them. We can. There's plenty of people that you can read and you can learn a lot from. There's plenty of guys that are wrong about a lot of stuff that you can read and learn a lot from if you have the discernment to do it. And I think this is one of those cases where Gary Chapman, the guy that wrote this book, I think he's got a lot of good information in here. And one of the reasons why I decided to do this study was because I could have just recommended to you that you read the book, The Five Love Languages, but I just know that nobody's going to do it. I'm going to recommend you do it. And some of you are going to say, yeah, it's a great idea. I should do that. Put it on your Amazon wish list and never get around to it. I know how it is. Others of you are going to say, oh, I don't need to read some book on marriage. I got it all figured out. Now, you're the type that needs to read it. You know, if you think you got it figured out and you don't need to read a book on it, then you definitely need to read a book on it. Pride goeth before destruction and haughty spirit before a fall. But since the chances are nobody's going to read it, I'll just get up here and read half of it to you in the sermon, and then that way you'll get all the high points. And I still recommend you read it after I get done preaching it. But if you don't, at least you got some of the high points. If you remember, the five love languages are the words of affirmation, quality time, gifts, acts of service, and physical touch. And we'll go through those five today, and I will give you some information about them, tell you what they are, tell them how you speak them, and then we'll learn how we figure out what our primary love language is, because each one of us, chances are, of these five, have one of them that is prominent in our lives. One of them is our primary love language. You think about love languages like languages, right? Languages are how you convey information, right? Well, love languages are how you convey love to somebody else. And if you don't speak somebody's language, you can't convey information to them. If you don't speak somebody's love language, you have a hard time conveying love to them because they feel love with certain things that you do. And if you're not doing or saying those certain things, then they don't really feel loved. That's kind of the whole purpose of it. So we want to figure out what our primary love language is. And then more importantly, you want to find out what your spouse's primary love language is. And then learn to speak it. Learn to say or do the things that makes your spouse feel loved. Now, if you think this is all silly, well then, you don't have to take it. I mean, I'm not giving you book, chapter, and verse. If you don't like it, don't take it. But I think if you take it, you'll benefit by it. I think you will. I think a lot of marriages have been helped and transformed by the information found in this book. So, you don't want to take it, don't take it. I just want to give you a quote just to start off with on the importance of learning your spouse's love language. Chapman says there, and I'm just going to refer to him as Chapman from here on, and I'm not going to give you the book is Five Love Languages, the Five Love Languages, I'm not going to give you the page, it's in the outline. He says, and I think this is very true, being sincere is not enough. We must be willing to learn our spouse's primary love language if we are to be effective communicators of love. And he's right. Being sincere doesn't cut it. You can be as sincere as you want, and if your spouse's primary love language is physical touch, and you're a gift giver, and he or she doesn't care about gifts, you can be as sincere and give all the gifts that you want, and that spouse is not going to feel loved because that's not their love language. Or words of affirmation. If your love language is words of affirmation, and you like to do acts of service, we'll say, and you're doing all kinds of things for your spouse, you're taking care of everything, but you haven't told him or her these words that make them feel loved and appreciated. All your acts of service are fine, being sincere is good, but the spouse is not going to feel loved. And then you're going to be frustrated and wonder, what in the world? I'm trying, I'm doing everything I know how to do, and my spouse isn't happy. Well, if you've been speaking Chinese to him or her for the last 3 years and she's not really feeling all that loved, it's not a wonder because you're not speaking her language. So here's the thing. It's important to learn your spouse's primary love language and learn how to speak it because chances are, statistically, his love language is going to be different than yours. Her love language will be different than yours. People that have the same love language are lucky. If you both happen to be words of affirmation or physical touch or gifts or acts of service or whatever, that's great because that comes natural to you. And you can do those things which are natural to you and your spouse receives them and everything's great. But chances are most people don't have the same love language. And then you get to learn to speak it. And it'd be like meeting a Chinese person. If you don't learn to speak Chinese, you're not going to be able to convey any information to him, and he's not going to be able to convey any to you. If you just assume that your spouse speaks the same love language as you do, you may think you're showing them love, but they won't feel like they're being loved, and it'll be a frustrating experience. Now, what I want to do is I want to give you a couple of quotes here, a couple from Chapman in his book, and then another one from C.S. Lewis. And I told you I wasn't going to change this outline at all. I also told you it was 2 years ago. It was actually a year and a half ago. It was in 2015, so close. And you round up, it was still. I didn't give you false information per se. It just wasn't the most precise information possible. But anyway, I did add this quote in this week because I remembered whenever I read Mere Christianity years ago, he had such a good quote about being in love that I wanted to add it in here. So I'm going to read something to you here. I talked about this briefly last time. The in love experience, you know, when you first meet somebody, you get the butterflies in your stomach and you can't think about anything else besides that person. And you lay awake thinking about them and they're always on your mind. You're always doing something nice and sweet for them and all that stuff. Yeah, that's great and fine, but it doesn't last. And it's good. I mean, some people disparage the whole being in love thing. Oh, that's just stupid. That's ridiculous. It's not stupid. It's not ridiculous. It's how God made us. Why do you think it universally happens to every single person under the face of the sun? Because that's the way that God made us. That's what draws people together initially, but it's not what keeps them together. It's what gets you together, but real love is what keeps you together. And I just want to give you a couple quotes here. I thought this was really good. He says, this is Chapman. He says, little by little, the illusion of intimacy evaporates and the individual desires, emotions, thoughts, and behavior patterns assert themselves. This is after people get married, after they were in love. They are two individuals. Their minds have not melded together and their emotions mingled only briefly in the ocean of love. Now the waves of reality begin to separate them. They fall out of love. And at that point, either they withdraw, separate, divorce, and set off in search of a new in-love experience, or they begin the hard work of learning to love each other without the euphoria of the in-love obsession. And that's why a lot of marriages fail, because any knuckle-dragger can fall in love. It's so easy. Everybody's done it, most everybody. You've been there. Anybody can do that. And what happens is you fall in love with some person that sometimes you shouldn't fall in love with. And that's why you've got to have discernment. That's why you've got to listen to the sermons. Go listen to the dating sermon. When you fall in love with somebody that you shouldn't marry, don't marry them. You've got to break it off. You've got to put those feelings aside, even though they're so strong, and think. Use your brain, not your heart. But so many people don't use their brains, they use their hearts. And they follow that in love feeling, and they end up making a very bad decision, and it can possibly have lifelong complications, consequences, thank you. And what he's saying here, and he's absolutely right, so people, they fall in love, they get married, and then they fall out of love, and that's totally normal. And when I say fall out of love, I mean you lose the in love feeling. Well, then when they lose that, they thought that this is what marriage is all about. They thought that this is the in-love feeling is what I should feel if I'm married to somebody. And when that feeling goes away, then they say, well, I married the wrong person. I'm not happy. I can't please this person. And they end up divorcing a lot of times. Now, when that happens, if you're not aware of it, and if you don't know it's going to happen ahead of time, it can catch you by surprise. If you know it's going to happen ahead of time, Then when that happens, you do the second one. You start the work of learning to love somebody, making a decision to love somebody. And it's hard work. Everybody knows that. Anybody that's married knows that it's hard work. Love is not nearly as much a feeling as it is a choice. At least in marriage, love is a choice. It's not easy. Chapman continues on the next page. He says, "Research seems to indicate that there is a third and better alternative to a life of misery or divorce. We can recognize the in-love experience for what it was, a temporary emotional high, and now pursue, quote, real love with our spouse. That kind of love is emotional in nature, but not obsessional. It is a love that unites reason and emotion. It involves an act of the will and requires discipline, and it requires the need for personal growth. Our most basic emotional need is not to fall in love, but to be genuinely loved by another, to know a love that grows out of reason and choice, not instinct." You see, falling in love is an instinct, but really loving is not an instinct. It actually goes against your instincts in many cases because you have to deny yourself and you have to make decisions and make choices and actions that are going to make your spouse feel loved. Loving is much more about your spouse than it is about you. "I need to be loved by someone who chooses to love me, who sees in me something worth loving. That kind of love requires effort and discipline. It is the choice to expend energy in an effort to benefit the other person, knowing that if his or her life is enriched by your effort, you too will find a sense of satisfaction, the satisfaction of having genuinely loved another. It does not require the euphoria of the in-love experience. In fact, true love cannot begin until the in-love experience has run its course." So nobody will believe me. I mean, you people will, you people that are married. But tell somebody that is dating somebody or somebody that's engaged to somebody that your love hasn't even started yet. And you say, "Oh, that's nonsense." No. Your love hasn't started yet. Not until you've been in the trenches for a while and the in-love thing is gone. And then you're choosing to love somebody when it's difficult to do so. That's when your love really starts. And that's not to say that you can't, you're never going to get the in-love feeling again. You're never going to, you know, have butterflies and have the person on your mind 24 hours a day. That's not going to happen again. But you can have the emotional aspect of it. You can have a genuine feeling of love and desire for that person and get a warm feeling in your heart about them. You can have that, but it takes some work. You got to come off the high and then start building back up. You're never going to get to the high again, but you're going to build back up to a level plateau is the hope anyway. Here's one more from Chapman. Same page. "During the in-love stage, we felt all those emotions. It was heavenly while it lasted." And anybody that's been there knows what he's talking about. "Our mistake was in thinking it would last forever, but that obsession was not meant to last forever. In the textbook of marriage, it is but the introduction. The heart of the book is rational, volitional love. That is the kind of love to which the sages have always called us. It is intentional." And then I want to give you the quote from C.S. Lewis. This is very good. I don't agree with everything that Lewis has to say, of course, but he's one of those guys where when he's good, he's good. And I just don't throw out the baby with the bathwater and say, "Oh, he was an Anglican, or he was a this or that, or didn't believe in six-day creation and eternal. He believed in eternal sonship or whatever." I don't care about. I mean, I care about that stuff, but I don't care what C.S. Lewis had to say about it. When he says something that's right and true, I'll take it. I'll learn from it. Here's the other thing that I love about this quote. Remember how I told you that I put together this sermon before I was married, and I did so for the purpose of preaching the same sermon later and saying, "See, you can know things in your head that are true, and you can teach things in your head that are true, even if you don't have personal experience with it." This quote that I'm going to read you, it's hard to believe, was written by a man who was not and never had been married. He was married later in life after he wrote this book, but he was not married when he wrote this quote. And he even addresses that after this quote. He's like, somebody's going to say, "Well, you're not married. How do you know?" And he said, "I'll tell you what. What I want you to do before you reject what I'm saying here, I want you to not base this on love novels. right, on romance novels, but go talk to real, actual people and see if the things that I'm saying are not true. And they are true. So anyway, when I get up here and tell you how you ought to raise your kids, if your thought is, what do you know? You don't have kids. Well, I got a Bible. I've been around for a few years. I've seen how it's done. I mean, I don't have to have them. Can I do, will I be better at it when I have kids? Of course I will. Will I know things that I can only learn through experience? Yeah, I can. But, you know, I don't have to have kids to know that I'm not going to let them stab each other with knives. Right? I mean, anybody going to say, well, how do you know you wouldn't let them stab each other with knives? You don't have kids yet. There's a lot of things I'm not going to let them do. I don't have to have kids to know what I'm not going to let them do. But anyway, let me read you C.S. Lewis's quote here. Being in love is a good thing, but it is not the best thing. There are many things below it, but there are also things above it. You cannot make it the basis of a whole life. It is a noble feeling, but it is still a feeling. Now, no feeling can be relied on to last. Now, no feeling can be relied on to last in its full intensity or even to last at all. Knowledge can last, principles can last, habits can last, but feelings come and go. The Bible teaches this. It teaches the same thing. Guide your heart in the way. Don't trust in your feelings. And in fact, whatever people say, the state called being in love, quote unquote, usually does not last. It is the fairy tale ending. If the old fairy tale ending, they lived happily ever after, is taken to mean they felt for the next 50 years exactly as they felt the day before they were married, then it says what probably never was nor ever would be true and would be highly undesirable if it were. Who could bear to live in that excitement for even 5 years? What would become of your work, your appetite, your sleep, your friendships? But of course, ceasing to be in love, quote unquote, need not mean ceasing to love. Love in this second sense, love as distinct from being in love, is not merely a feeling. It is a deep unity maintained by the will and deliberately strengthened by habit, reinforced by, in Christian marriages, the grace which both partners ask and receive from God. They can have this love for each other even at those moments when they do not like each other, as you love yourself even when you do not like yourself. They can retain this love even when each would easily, if they allowed themselves, be in love with someone else. Being in love first moved them to promise fidelity. This quieter love enables them to keep the promise. It is on this love that the engine of marriage is run. Being in love was the explosion that started it. Does anybody have any disagreement with those wise words? I don't. This was a guy that wasn't even married, had never been married. Listen to what he says. Those are some wise words. I am married. I couldn't have come up with something that good. I'll be quite honest with you. So don't chuck somebody's advice or opinion just because they haven't personally been there yet. Some people just have wisdom and they can observe the world around them and they can figure stuff out even if they haven't experienced it themselves. Let me just back this up with the Bible, this idea of the in love phase not lasting. There was a guy named Ammon back in 2 Samuel 13, verses 1 through 2. Ammon was a son of David, and Ammon was a wicked man, and Ammon had a desire for his sister, half-sister I think it was, Tamar. 2 Samuel 13, 1 through 2. Now Ammon was in love with Tamar, with his sister. 2 Samuel 13, 1 through 2. And it came to pass after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a fair sister whose name was Tamar, and Ammon, the son of David, loved her. And Ammon was so vexed that he fell sick for his sister. He was lovesick, right? Isn't that what we say? He fell sick for his sister, Tamar, for she was a virgin, and Ammon thought it hard for him to do anything to her. So Ammon is in love with Tamar. He's really in lust with Tamar. Well, then if you remember what happened, Ammon, he contrived a little, somebody else helped him out to contrive this scheme to get Tamar into his room by herself. And Ammon then grabbed her and had his way with her. And here's what I want to show you. The in love feeling, the emotion, can be just turned off in a heartbeat. You can be in love and out of love very quickly. And this is what happened to this wicked man, Ammon. Verses 14 and 15. Howbeit he would not hearken unto her voice when she was crying not to be raped, but being stronger than she, forced her and lay with her. Then Ammon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he had loved her. And Ammon said unto her, Arise, be gone. This is how fickle emotions are. Especially when you do something reprehensible like that, whenever you have a strong desire for somebody, and then after you do that, you've defiled the person, then he wants nothing to do with her. He got his desire, and maybe it wasn't all that he thought it was going to be, or maybe now he realizes he's screwed because he just did something horrible, or whatever, and his emotions changed on a dime. So you never want to make a choice based on emotions. Don't make a choice of marriage based on emotions. You've got to put the emotions aside, and it's hard to do. Put them aside. Listen. None of you are dating right now, but listen to that dating series, or you might be someday. Listen to the dating series is what I'm trying to tell you. And whenever I was doing it, follow what I did. I followed what I did, so follow what I did. It worked out well for me. Make yourself limits. Don't do certain things until certain time periods have passed. Don't get engaged until certain time has passed. Don't say I love you till certain things of times has gone by and whatever. If you do that, and if you force yourself to stretch out the time, then eventually your head will catch up with your heart. But if you don't stretch out the time, your heart's going to go ahead of your head, and you're going to make, could be, a horrible mistake. Love is a choice, not a feeling. I'm going to give you another quote here. Chapman says, love is the attitude that says, I'm married to you and I choose to love you I choose to look out for your interests. Then the one who chooses to love will find appropriate ways to express that decision. That's what you do. You choose to love, choose to look out for the interest, and then once you've made the choice, then you will figure out ways to do it. They might not even come natural to you. You might have to learn to do them, practice them, and then they'll become habits eventually, even if they're not natural to you right now. Chapman said, love is something you do for someone else, not something you do for yourself. You see, being in love, though you do things for the other person a lot, but you're really doing it for yourself because you just love the feeling of it. And you want to do anything, you're just so wrapped up in the emotion of it. But once you're married for a while, then it's not like that anymore. And if you're just with your spouse for what you can get out of her, and you're with her for the wrong reason, and your marriage is going to suffer because of that. Your love should be focused on what you can do for her. A pastor that I knew a long, long time ago said one time something. I don't have his exact quote, but this is how I remember it anyway. He said, love is not always a feeling, it's a commitment. And that's true. And anybody that's been married, especially the longer you've been married, you know that's true. Love, if it's going to last, is a commitment. And you got to remember that commitment, even when it gets hard, difficult. That's what the traditional vows say, right? Sickness and in health, better or worse, till death do you part. Okay, now let's go over the five love languages. The first one is words of affirmation. This language uses words to affirm other people. Chapman says, verbal compliments or words of appreciation are powerful communicators of love. And I don't think I'm telling you anything you don't know. Everybody knows that, right? But let me give you some examples of words of affirmation. Now, we'll learn at the end of the sermon how you find out if this is your love language, and more importantly, how you find out if this is your spouse's love language. But at least you'll learn some things that you could say. And as I look through this list, I realize that I say these things a lot because this is my wife's primary love language. I honestly don't remember if I got all these from Chapman or myself or a combination or what. I didn't put a quote here, so anyway. Encouraging words. You look great in that outfit. That's a nice thing to say. You look very pretty today or very handsome today. You can never go wrong telling your wife that she looks pretty today. Never go wrong with that. And if her love language is words of affirmation, ding, you just got a point. Got that from Mark Gunger. Why? Just Google Mark Gunger, and it's like marriage counseling through laughter or something. The guy is hysterical. He gave a whole presentation to a great big group of people on marriage, and man, that guy, and he's fun, and everything, what he says is true, and he does it through comedy and laughter, and man, is he good. But anyway, you're such a hard worker. That's a great thing to tell your wife or your husband. Make them feel loved. I'm so blessed to have a husband or a wife like you. You should tell your spouse that. Even if their love language isn't words of affirmation, you should tell them that. Let them know that. Tell your wife you love her every day, at least once. Then you have positive words like, this meal was excellent, or thanks for mowing the grass, or you're so good with the kids. You know, positive words. Now, to somebody whose love language is words of affirmation, that stuff, that makes a big difference. They love to hear that kind of stuff. Now, to some of you, maybe your love language isn't words of affirmation. You're like, who cares? You know, I think I need to have her tell me I did a good job mowing the grass. I don't care about that. Well, your love language isn't words of affirmation. But if your wife's is, then you're going to have to get over that attitude of, that's stupid, and think, okay, I got to remember to say things that affirm her, that make her feel loved. Or kind words, like the good old, I love you, or you're very special to me, or I don't know what I'd do without you. Those are good words. Of course, you want to say everything you say, you want it to be true. So don't say something that's just outrageous and that's not true, or something that's just pure flattery. I'm not telling you to flatter her. I'm telling you to tell her true things that'll make her feel loved. If the meal wasn't excellent, you don't have to say it was excellent. Just don't say anything, or say thank you for the meal, or, you know, it was nutritious, but I like your other meals better, or whatever. You know, you got to be diplomatic. Go read the book How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. It'll help you out. And then you have forgiving words. I don't have examples of that, but like, I forgive you. That would probably be a pretty good one there. But I do have a quote here from Chapman. I think this is rather good. He says, love doesn't keep a score of wrongs. Love doesn't bring up past failures. None of us is perfect. In marriage, we do not always do the best or right thing. Have I got a witness? Anybody? Is that true? We don't always do the best or right thing? Yeah. Nobody raised their hands. Apparently, you guys are all perfect. Okay, there. Okay, we do. Okay, good, good. We do have. Jason still hasn't raised his hand. But anyway, I know he's nodding his head inside, I'm sure. We have sometimes done or said hurtful things to our spouses. I think everybody knows that's true. We cannot erase the past. We can only confess and agree that it was wrong. As much as you'd like to erase the past, you can't. You can't take back the words. It doesn't matter how badly you feel about it. The only thing that you can do is just say, I'm sorry, will you please forgive me? And mean it. That's the only thing you can do. Now, when you do that, your spouse has a choice. We'll get into that in just a second. We can ask for forgiveness and try to act differently in the future. And of course, that's the key to it. Don't just ask for forgiveness and do the same thing over again intentionally. At least try to do better next time. Having confessed my failure and asked forgiveness, I can do nothing more to mitigate the hurt that I may have caused my spouse. When I have been wronged by my spouse and she has painfully confessed it and requested forgiveness, I have the option of justice or forgiveness. If you go for justice, your marriage is going to be destroyed. If I choose justice and seek to pay her back or make her pay for her wrongdoing, I am making myself the judge and she the felon. Intimacy becomes impossible. If, however, I choose to forgive, intimacy can be restored. Forgiveness is the way of love. I am amazed, listen to this, I am amazed by how many individuals mess up every new day with yesterday. You think about that. How many people mess up today with yesterday? They bring up what happened yesterday, or a year ago, or 10 years ago, or whatever. They don't forget about it. They insist on bringing into today the failures of yesterday, and in so doing, they pollute a potentially wonderful day. You got to forgive, and then what's the next thing? Forget, right? Now, you're never going to be able to forget in the sense that it's not going to be in your memory. When it says that God forgets our iniquities, he'll remember them no more, does that mean that if somebody asks God, hey, did Chad get drunk when he was a teenager? And the Lord says, I don't remember of it. Of course he remembers, but he doesn't remember it against you. He's not going to bring it up and judge you for it again. That's what it means when you forget. Forgive and forget. Chapman goes on to say, forgiveness is not a feeling, it is a commitment. It is a choice to show mercy, not to hold the offenses up against the offender. Forgiveness is an expression of love. And it is. Turn with me to Ephesians 1 and verse 7. Forgiveness is one of the greatest expressions of love. I'm going to give you verses from time to time to back up some of these points. I don't have time, unless I stretch this into three or more sermons, to back it all up. Ephesians 1 and verse 7. It says, in whom we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins according to the riches of his grace. We read about God where his great love, it says there in verse 4 of chapter 2, but God, who is rich in mercy, for his great love wherewith he loved us, even when we were dead in sins, hath quickened us together with Christ. By grace you are saved. That was a great act of love. And if you compare that with Colossians, when it says that he quickened us, having forgiven you all trespasses. When he quickened you, he forgave you. That was a great act of love on God's part to forgive you. And think about it. Think about it, you people that are married or anybody that's been offended by somebody else. Whenever somebody's done something to hurt you, and I mean it really hurts, it's hard to forgive, isn't it? It'd be a lot easier just to be mad at that person and just to not let them off the hook. It takes a lot of love to forgive somebody. Sometimes, you know, just give yourself a few minutes, too. It's not like, I mean, if you've done something grievous to your spouse, you say, I'm so sorry, please forgive me, and then they're just not instantly happy with you, you can't expect them to be instantly happy with you. Give them a while. Give them a half an hour. Let them go sit in the room by themselves and just think it over. That helps me. Just kind of go just sit and just think it over for a little bit, and it'll, you know, the feeling will subside, and then just let it go, and don't bring it up again. And then there's humble words. Like asking for something instead of demanding it. That's a way of showing love. Remember what it says in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 4? Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up. Charity doesn't give demanding and harsh words, but charity humbly requests and asks for things. Now let me give you some pointers if your spouse's primary love language is words of affirmation. Number one, remember that words are important. Remember that. If you already know that your spouse's primary love language is words of affirmation, burn this one into your memory. Remember that words are important. You cannot play fast and loose with words if this is how your spouse receives love. So you got to be really careful with what you say. You can joke around with somebody like you're joking around with the guys if your wife isn't that tight. But if her language is words of affirmation, don't joke like you joke with other people. Make sure to give your spouse a sincere compliment every day. Just try to remember to do that. Write a love letter to your spouse. They'll eat that up. Women will eat that up in general. I bet you even if their love language isn't words of affirmation, write a love letter to your spouse. I haven't done that in a while. I need to do that. See, I told you, I'm preaching to me too. Leave them little notes around the house or in the car. I was reviewing this the Friday, and I thought, I haven't done that for a while. So I got out my notepad. I wrote a little note that said, Mahal, Mahal, Namahal, Kita, which means, in Tagalog, being interpreted, I love you very much. And I posted it on the mirror in the bathroom. And then I heard her go into the bathroom. And she comes out, she didn't say anything. I thought, she must not have seen that. Because, I mean, I felt for sure. Well, then the second time she goes into the bathroom, and I literally heard a shriek. I mean, she was so excited. It was just you would have thought that I left her a 5-carat diamond ring in there or something like that. That's what I'm telling you. When our language is words of affirmation, learn to say things that make her feel loved. Compliment your spouse in the presence of their parents or friends. Look for your spouse's strengths and then tell them how much you appreciate those qualities in them. She or he, they're not going to be good at everything, right? Don't compliment them on things that they're not any good at. Number one, they're going to know that you're lying anyway. Don't do that. But find the good things and compliment them on those. Tell your children how great their mother or father is, both in their presence and when they're not around. And here's some more. Never insult your wife. This goes regardless. Never insult your wife. Do not make fun of your wife's weight. Never do that. Remember, inside every woman there's a little girl. And little, that hurts. Don't do that. Don't joke about your wife's looks. Don't do that. That is very damaging to a woman. Most women already struggle with a low self-image. That's what I've read anyway. Most women struggle with a low self-image. You can joke about a guy's looks and he doesn't care about it. You joke about a woman's looks, that's a totally different story. The next one is quality time. This language is all about giving the other person your undivided attention. The key word there is undivided. I'll give you some examples. Chapman says, by quality time, I mean giving someone your undivided attention. I don't mean sitting on the couch watching television together. That's not quality time. You can be sitting in the same room together and you're not having quality time. You could even be sitting there with no TV on, with no nothing, and just even talking, and it's still maybe not quality time if you're not giving that person your total focus and really being concerned about with what they have to say. It takes some special time to be considered quality time. Chapman says, some husbands and wives think they are spending time together when, in reality, they are only living in close proximity. That's the truth. They are in the same house at the same time, but they are not together. A wife who is texting while her husband tries to talk to her is not giving him quality time because he does not have her full attention. And let me just give you some advice. Number one, this is becoming a major problem in our day, this texting stuff. Don't talk to somebody when they're looking at their phone. This is what I recommend. If I'm talking to somebody, more than likely, and they look at their face, start playing with their phone, I'll stop talking. And then they'll realize the silence and they'll look up. I'll say, I'm just waiting until I have your attention. You got to do that sometimes. Don't talk to somebody when they're looking at their phone. You'll let them know how rude they're being just by your silence. And then they'll stop. Well, maybe they will if they have any sense about them at all. Although people today have no social etiquette whatsoever, so they probably wouldn't even notice. They weren't paying attention to you talking anyway because they were looking at whatever was on their phone. Parents, don't let your kids use their phone or electronics at restaurants or in the presence of others. Don't let your kids do that. You know how bad that looks? You don't realize how bad it is until you see other people doing it. You can sit there in a restaurant, you don't think anything of it. When I look and I see somebody else doing it at a restaurant, especially if they're at a table with other people and they're looking at their phones, I'm like, what the heck is wrong with this person? Are they an alien? Do they not know how to talk to other people or what? Don't let your kids do that. This is my recommendation. Tell your kids to put that thing away. If you even give it to them to start with. I recommend not giving them a smartphone. I wouldn't give my kids a smartphone at least until they are old enough to have their own job, making their own money, and they pay for it entirely by themselves. I would not give them a cell phone until they can pay for it by themselves with their own money after they gave God his 10% and after they saved 10%. That will limit the age right there. How old your kid got to be to get to that point? At least 16, probably 17. You say, easy for you to say, you don't have kids. Watch me. I know you'll be watching me like a hawk. And I don't care. Watch me like a hawk. It's good. I hope you watch me like a hawk. I hope you do. And I hope God gives me grace to do the right thing. Teach your kids how to socialize. It is horribly unsocial when you're at a restaurant with a group of people and you're just looking at your phone. That is terribly unsocial. Kids, well, adults, nobody knows how to socialize anymore because of these stupid phones. I got a quote for you here in just a minute. Limit the use of video games. Teach your kids how to read and to use their imaginations, especially the younger they are. Remember the series that I did on the digital invasion? We talked about all that stuff. That stuff is dangerous to kids when they're little. The littler they are, the more dangerous it is to them. Why do you think we have a bunch of brain-dead zombies running around today? It's because kids are raised on video games and TV and smartphones. You'd be wise to limit that stuff. I will not have it in my house. I'm just telling you what my convictions are. I'm not saying you got to follow my convictions, but I would not have it in my house. My idea here is that you will be sorry how much you let your children use computers, smartphones, and video games. You will be sorry how much you let them use that. Now, they may turn out all right. You say, well, I let my kid do it, and he turned out okay. Okay, that's fine. Maybe he did. What if they don't? What if they don't? Your job as a parent is to say no. But what are they going to do? Everybody else has video games. Listen to Chris's exhortation again. That's what you do. Who gives a crap what anybody else thinks? Who cares what they think? Oh, my kids are going to be deprived. Well, you deprive them of lots of stuff, don't you, that you think is harmful for them? You're the parent, remember. Let me read you a quote here. This is from a article called Social Media Making Millennials Less Social. It's a study. It was on CNBC.com. I got the link there. You can read it for yourself. This is from 2015. It's something everyone suspected, but now it's official. The under 30 crowd is addicted to their cell phones. Those are the findings of a new survey which showed that as millennials spend more time engaged on social media platforms, it's causing them to be less social in real life. Absolutely. Anybody that's just looked around knows that's the case. Kids don't know how to talk to people anymore. Kids don't know how to talk to adults anymore. That's for sure. The study conducted by FlashGap, a photo sharing application with more than 150,000 users, found that 87% of millennials admitted to missing out on a conversation because they were distracted by their phone. 87%. Okay, so quality time, quality conversation. That was just a little rant there that I thought was necessary to make you aware of once in a while. I haven't said anything about it for quite some time. And by the way, don't think, because I don't say something to you in private about every little thing, that I'm not paying attention. You say, well, boy, you get up and rail on it in the sermon, and then you don't say anything in private. I railed on it in the sermon. I don't need to address every little thing in private. Quality conversation. Chapman says, words of affirmation focused on what we are saying, whereas quality conversation focuses on what we are hearing. Think about that. The first one that we looked at, that's what you're saying. That's the main focus. But with quality time, it's what you're hearing. Okay, so remember that. Women like to be listened to and understood. Everybody Understand that? Women like to be listened to and they like to be understood. And that's a hard thing for a man, because if they're saying something, if they're explaining their feelings about something to you and it just doesn't make rational sense, like this just doesn't, you know, because men think more rationally and you're just thinking this doesn't make sense. And then you're trying to explain, well, no, that's not right. Think about this. And she just says, I just want you to understand me. Sometimes I don't even understand what that means, but okay, so just understand, just say, okay, I understand what you're saying, even if it doesn't make a lot of sense. I understand what you're saying. It's kind of hard. It's kind of difficult sometimes. But they like to be understood. At least acknowledge their feelings. Even if the feelings you think are a little kooky, they don't make any sense, acknowledge the feelings. I understand you're sad. I understand you're mad. I understand whatever. Men like to listen, assess the problem, and offer a solution. I mean, after all, to me, that's the whole point. If somebody comes to me and tells me about a problem, why are they telling me about the problem? They want a solution. Now, if they are a man, that's why they're telling you about the problem, probably because they want a solution. But if they're a woman, they're just telling you about the problem just for the sheer enjoyment of telling you about the problem. They're not really looking for a solution. And that's usually the case with women. They just want to tell you about the problem. Men, sometimes your wives just need you to listen to her problem and just show that you understand and care. And I just heard a great quote. Pastor Mott told me that Pastor Gerald told him, and Pastor Gerald didn't remember where he heard it, but he said that there are problems in life, some of which have a solution, and others have an outcome. You think about that for a while. Some problems have a solution. Others don't. They just have an outcome. There are some problems that there is no solution to. You just got to bear it, and whatever is going to happen is going to happen, and you just got to deal with it. Some problems just don't have solutions. Carol Paul, the famous Ron Paul's wife, said this. I think she may have been quoting her husband. I don't remember. She said, unsolicited advice is useless. And that's generally true. But even though it's generally true, a wise man will still welcome unsolicited advice. I do. I welcome it. I mean, I've had people, I've called them up and tell them about something, and they'll say, and I usually do the same thing. If somebody doesn't ask for my advice, I'll say, well, do you want my advice? Would you like it? And if somebody says that, you know, I know you didn't ask, I'm like, by all means, please tell me. I want the advice. I want to know. So wise men will want the advice, even if they didn't think to ask for it. Proverbs 9 and verse 9. Fools will not want the advice, though a fool that tries to pretend like a wise man will say, oh yes, please, give me your advice, but he doesn't want it and he's not going to listen to it anyway. Proverbs 9 and verse 9. Give instruction to a wise man and he will be yet wiser. Teach a just man and he will increase in learning. Let me give you some practical tips for quality conversation. Number one, maintain eye contact when your spouse is talking. This is an important thing with quality conversation. Look at the person, and this is in marriage or just in life. Look at the person you're talking to. Now, conversation is an art, and some people are really good at it. And there's almost a good balance between looking at somebody and looking away. You ever talk to somebody and they're good at that? They'll look at you just for the right amount of time, and then they'll kind of look away as they're saying something, like they're thinking, and then they'll look back at you. If somebody just stares at you the whole time and you can't get away from them, that's kind of uncomfortable. At least it is for me. But if somebody's always looking like this and they're talking to you and they never look at you, that's just weird too. So you got to get that good balance. But just start out by learning to look somebody in the eye. See, I'm talking to you. Look them in the eye. Look them in the eye. Look them in the eye. See, she's not looking at me. Look her in the eye. Look them in the eye. Look her in the eye. See? Look them straight in the eye when you're talking to them. Teach your kids to do that. You want your kids to be successful out there in the world? Teach them to look at somebody in the eye when they talk to them, to smile when they talk to them, to have a good firm handshake, to show up on time and do at least what is required. I was talking to Chris. He's telling me he just got a promotion. He won't tell you. He's too humble. He got a promotion to manager. 19 years old. He's a full-blown manager at work. And Chris says, all I really just do is show up and do what they tell me. Just do my job. Said, yeah, right. That's all you got to do is just show up and do your job and show up on time and do a good job. If you do that, you are so far ahead of all of your brain dead zombie peers that you're going to go far in life. You don't even have to really be all that much of an all-star. Now, in Chris's case, he's way better than that. But if you just simply do what you're supposed to do and show up on time, you'll do fine. Don't do anything else when you're listening to your spouse. If you're trying to have quality time, don't be doing something else. You can't have quality time when you're doing the dishes and not, you know, looking somebody in the eye and giving them your undivided attention. Listen for feelings. Confirm the feelings you think you hear. It's hard for guys to do this, but women eat that stuff up. Listen for the feelings. And I need to learn this stuff too. And when you feel her talking, you say, "Oh, does that make you sad?" or something, or, "Oh, did that make you angry?" And it just sounds almost ridiculous, like, "Well, yeah, of course she's," you know. But they like that. Then they know you're listening, you're paying attention. Observe body language. And do not interrupt. Do not interrupt. This is harder for some people than others. Some people, it's just, that's their thing. They're used to interrupting. That's the way that their family does things. That's the way that they are. And with some people, that's okay, I guess. If they're used to that, they don't mind being interrupted. I'm not used to that. I don't like being interrupted. And if I'm interrupted, usually I'll just stop talking. And if I'm telling somebody something that I think is very important and they interrupt me or they're not paying attention, I just figure, you know what? Apparently it's not important. It's important to me, but it is obviously not important. And usually I just stop talking and I don't try to bring it up again unless they say, "Oh, what were you saying? I'm sorry, I got sidetracked," or whatever. I don't like it. And if your spouse's love language is quality time, do not interrupt. Learn to talk. Now, for some people, this is really easy because some people are talkers. But for some people that are more quiet, and I tend to be one of them, it's not quite so easy to learn how to talk. Don't mistake preaching for talking, because I can preach all day long. Right? I can get up here. Sometimes, I mean, you have a personal conversation with me, and you make a comment on the sermon, and I'm just like, "Yep, uh-huh." And I don't hardly have anything to say about it. And yet up here, I can preach on for days if I want to. Don't mistake conversation for preaching. It's not conversation. Learn to talk. Chapman said, "Quality conversation requires not only sympathetic listening, but also self-revelation." That's when you really spend quality time with somebody, is when you reveal something about yourself to them. So it's talking and it's listening. And that makes somebody feel that you love them, because I don't just reveal myself to any old guy out there, right? I have to trust somebody and at least like them, if not love them, to really reveal anything real personal about myself to them. And if you do that to your spouse especially, that makes her or him feel very loved whenever you reveal what's really deep within your heart. And you'll put yourself out there. And you'll say things that maybe you feel uncomfortable saying, like you feel vulnerable saying. And that makes your spouse feel very loved, because you would confide in her or in him those things. Many men have difficulty expressing their feelings. I think some men only have one feeling. I don't think, you know, some men, or at least they appear to. Men have a hard time with that thing, with that type of thing. Opening oneself up to another person and revealing deep personal feelings is an act of love, which requires trust, like I just said. And then, of course, you have quality activities. Doing activities with your spouse that they love is an act of love. It's worth it to do an activity with your spouse that you don't particularly enjoy, but they do, because it shows that you love them. So do something with your spouse. Spend the quality time with them doing whatever they want to do. Ask them, "What do you want to do today?" And do whatever they want to do. Chapman says, one of the byproducts of quality activities is that they provide a memory bank from which to draw in the years ahead. Now that is a good thought. Think about it. Think about fun things that you've done with somebody in the past that you still remember today. And you can almost relive what you did with that person to this day. Some of the trips that Seth and I have taken, or things like that. My mom and I took that trip around the country back in 2010. Wonderful trip, and we still remember that. We still talk about it from time to time. And it wasn't just the 2 weeks that I spent with my mom, that quality time, but it's something that has lasted for years and will probably last my entire life. So whenever you can do something special, it doesn't have to be a great big trip like that. It can be something just around town or whatever, but do something special. We went mini golfing or whatever. We had a good time doing that. You know, it builds memories. So do something like that. The next one is gifts. For some people, what makes them feel most loved is to receive a gift. Having receiving gifts as your primary love language doesn't necessarily mean that the person is covetous, any more than it means that a person who feels loved by words of affirmation has a low self-esteem, or a person who feels loved by quality time is needy and insecure. So just because your love language is receiving gifts, don't feel guilty saying that, I don't want to be a covetous individual. I don't want to be greedy. That's not what it's about. It's not about greed. It's just about that feeling, that happy, warm feeling when somebody gives you something. Even if it's just a little something, doesn't very insignificant, it makes you feel happy. So you don't feel like you're greedy or covetous or anything. That's not the case. These are just different ways in which different people feel loved. The gifts don't necessarily have to be expensive. Gifts could be things like flowers, candy, bringing home a pizza for dinner, or souvenirs from a vacation. If your spouse, his or her, love language is giving gifts, when you go on a trip, make sure and get them something and bring them home, a little souvenir. Preferably something that probably says the name of the place where you were, or something like that. That means a lot to somebody whose love language is receiving gifts. Now my love language isn't receiving gifts, and I mean, I like it, you know, and I appreciate the thought, but it's not a big deal to me. And if somebody went on a trip and didn't bring me back a coffee mug, I'm not going to be hurt at all. It's not a big deal. But somebody that has that love language, they may really be expecting. They want something because they, well, you know what they really want to know? They want to know that you were thinking about them when you were away. Because when you're on a trip, if you buy them something, that means you were thinking about them whenever you were off having a good time. So just try to remember that. Gifts could also be something handmade. Probably wouldn't work for me because I don't have an artistic bone in my body, but some people prefer practical gifts. Husbands, learn your wives. Learn whether your wife likes a practical gift or a non-practical gift. Some husbands are so clueless. Some wives actually like practical gifts. You know what I got my wife for her birthday? A cast iron wok. You know, the cooking thing. She likes practical gifts, so that's what I got her. So don't just assume that your wife wants some little cutesy thing or whatever that's going to be useless. If your wife likes practical gifts, if she wants a vacuum cleaner for her birthday or whatever, then get her a vacuum cleaner. I mean, you got to learn what your wife likes. Now, what if gift giving doesn't come naturally to you? Because that's the thing. With all these love languages, it may not come naturally to you. If it's not your language, it's going to be harder to remember to do those things, right? So what if it doesn't come naturally? Well, here's what I say. Make yourself a recurring reminder to buy your spouse something. I don't have to worry about this because this isn't her love language. But you've got a phone, right? You've got one of these smartphones that I just railed against telling you how horrible they are. Take that thing and use it for something useful. Get it out and say, remind me to buy myself buy my wife a gift on Friday at 4 o'clock when you know you're going to be out and about or whatever. Put a recurring reminder on your Gmail calendar. It'll pop up once a month or once a week or once every 2 weeks. Buy my wife a gift. And then you'll remember. Or have someone that's good at buying gifts go with you to help you find something if you're no good at it yourself. Then we have acts of service, the fourth one. For these people, actions speak louder than words. Chapman says, such actions as cooking a meal, setting a table, washing dishes, vacuuming, cleaning a commode, or a toilet for most people. My dad calls it a commode. That must be an old an old thing. Changing a baby's diaper, dusting the bookcase, keeping the car in operating condition, paying the bills, trimming the shrubs, walking the dog, changing the cat's litter box, and dealing with landlords and insurance companies are all acts of service. They require thought, planning, time, effort, and energy. If done with a positive spirit, they are indeed expressions of love. Now, if done with a grumbling spirit, you're like, okay, I'll call the insurance company, I'll get the lawn mowed or whatever, then it's not an act of love. So as you can see, he just listed off, what, half a dozen things easily that any one of you can do that if your spouse has that as a love language. Now, probably all these things would appeal to all of us at least a little bit. All of us probably like all these things. So even if this isn't your love language, you can still take these things and try to do them. You know, once in a while, I mean, my wife, words of affirmation, I already told you that. But she loves it whenever I pick up my dish and carry it over to the sink after dinner. She likes that, you know, so do it. I mean, it's not going to hurt me any. It's not a big thing, right? Now, if you're married to someone whose primary love language is acts of service, they may have fell in love with you, listen to this, when you were dating because you did things for them. And if that's the case, then you don't want to slack off after you're married. Because when you're in love, won't you pretty much do anything for somebody? I mean, you'd bend over backwards. You'd take the dishes away. You would open the door for her. You would, I still do that. I still open the door for my wife. Learned that from Mary Dell Gerald. She taught me to do that. But you'll do any of that stuff, right? Well, if your wife's love language is acts of service, and you were doing all those things when you were dating, when you were in love, that's why she fell in love with you. He's so nice. He's so sweet. He does everything for me. And then you get married and he stops doing it all because he's not in love anymore, right? You got to keep that up. Chapman said, what we do for each other before marriage is no indication of what we will do after marriage. Let me read that one again. What we do for each other before marriage is no indication of what we will do after marriage. That's why you've got to think with your brain when you're dating. You've got to try to look past the emotion and look at that person and get to know that person with your brain to make sure to see what kind of a person they really are, because they're not going to be the same person after you've been married for a while as they were when you were dating and you were in love. You've got to think with your brain and get yourself in that mindset now, because there are two people, as D. Ruma said, two people you can never reason with, a drunk and somebody that's in love. Instill it in your children to find a good spouse of like faith, because if you don't instill it in them, and I mean drive it into them so that this is just second nature, if you don't instill it in them, whenever they meet the first cute girl and they fall in love, it is over. It is over. It doesn't matter what you say to them. You can try to reason with them. It's not going to matter. You cannot reason with somebody in love. You've got to instill it in them from the beginning. I've just seen this thing happen too many times. That's why I harp on it. It's so important. Where was I? Okay. Before marriage, we are carried along by the force of the in-love obsession. After marriage, we revert to being the people we were before we fell in love. Think about that. Amen. That's right. That's right. You're not going to change. I mean, come on. People don't change. Maybe a little bit over time, but you know, if you are who you are now and then you meet and fall in love, you're going to end up being just who you are right now. You're not going to change that much. And if you do, it's going to require a lot of work and effort. It's not going to come naturally. Make a list of things your spouse has asked you to do over the past few weeks and do one per week as an act of love. So this is what you do. If your spouse's primary love language is acts of service, make a list. You know, the honey-do list, right? Women love to make the list for their husbands. They want this and that done. So make your list and then at least check off one of them a week. And you'll be getting double points there, because you're doing stuff that needs done already and it's an act of love. Ask your spouse for a list of 10 things that he or she would really like you to do in the next month. Ask them to prioritize them for you and then do them as an act of love. Do the high priority ones, you'll really make score some points. Take note of things that your spouse nags you to do and then do them. You think, I don't know, acts of service, I can't think of anything to do. Just think, what does your spouse nag you about? You got your answer. Women, like, they kind of have a propensity to nag a bit. You know, they'll tell you what they want and just listen, and then you know what to do. Now, if you have more money than time, you could hire it out to somebody else, and they could do the things around the house that need done. You still get points for acts of service because you did it. You made sure it got done anyway, even if you didn't actually do it yourself. Okay, now the last one, physical touch. To this person, nothing speaks more deeply than appropriate touch. Physical touch is vital for a human being's well-being. This is from Chapman. He says, numerous research projects in the area of child development have reached that conclusion. Babies who are held, hugged, and kissed develop a healthier emotional life than those who are left for long periods of time without physical contact. So, by all means, if you have a baby, and if we have a baby, hug them, kiss them, hold them, talk to them. That's really important. That baby talk stuff with babies, from what I've read, it's not just, I mean, it's natural to us, I think, because God made it natural to us because it's important for the baby. God knows what he's doing. But I told you about that story that happened a long time ago when that one knucklehead king of, I forget, some European country, he wanted to find out what language a person would naturally learn if they didn't ever hear a language, because they had this idea of innate, inborn knowledge or something. And so he took 50 babies and he had them just kind of quarantined off, and a nurse would go and feed them and take care of them but never talk to them. They all died. They all died. Babies need to be talked to, need to be held, coddled, kissed, hugged, all that kind of stuff. So physical touch is very important. Now, how to touch? This is from Chapman again. In marriage, the touch of love may take many forms. Since touch receptors are located throughout the body, lovingly touching your spouse almost anywhere can be an expression of love. That does not mean that all touches are created equal. Some will bring more pleasure to your spouse than others. Your best indicator is your spouse, of course. After all, she is the one you are seeking to love. She knows best what she perceives as a loving touch. Don't insist on touching her in your way, in your time. Learn to speak her love dialect. Your spouse may find some touches uncomfortable or irritating. To insist on continuing those touches is to communicate the opposite of love. It is saying that you are not sensitive to her needs and that you care little about her perceptions of what is pleasant. Don't make the mistake of believing that the touch that brings pleasure to you will also bring pleasure to her. This is true. I'll give you an example. My poor wife, she gets used as an example all the time. She doesn't like it when you put your arm around her and rest your arm on her shoulder. I don't know why. Ask her. I can't figure it out why she doesn't like that. But I like doing that. You just sit there like you're doing right now, you know, where if your arm is like on, resting like that. Yeah, well, not exactly like that. But when it's resting on her shoulder, but she doesn't like that. So maybe that's my way of showing somebody love, but that ain't showing her love. She doesn't like that. I may as well be putting her in a full Nelson or something. So you got to learn what she likes and what she doesn't, or what he likes and what he doesn't. Chapman says, if your spouse's primary love language is physical touch, nothing is more important than holding her as she cries. That's the truth. That's probably true of most women, I would think, but especially if her language is physical touch. Hold her as she cries. Now, if you're the one that made her cry, she might not want you to hold her. But if you didn't make her cry, then you definitely hold her. Here's some tips if your spouse's primary love language is physical touch. As you walk to the car to go shopping, reach out and hold your spouse's hand. That's an easy one. While eating together, let your knee or foot drift over and touch your spouse. This is called footsie, sort of. While your spouse is seated, walk up behind her and give her a shoulder massage. That always feels good. I think, well, my love language is physical touch. That sounds real good to me. I love that kind of thing. I'll know if you're trying to butter me up if you walk up and say, "Hey, Pastor, I got a question about something. You're massaging my..." I don't like his massages, but that's a different story. That's a different story. I got the bruises to prove it. When you sit together in church, when the minister calls for prayer, reach over and hold your spouse's hand. This is what Chapman says anyway. That's a good idea. When family or friends are visiting, touch your spouse in their presence. Putting your arm around him as you stand talking or simply placing your hand on her shoulders says, "Even with all these people in the house, I still see you." Makes her feel special. Don't neglect your spouse. When you're in a group of people, don't forget about your spouse. Especially if you're one that likes to talk and you get talking, you know, I can do that. If I get talking to somebody I'm interested in, I forget I'm married. I don't even, you know, and then I got to remind myself. When your spouse arrives at home, meet him or her one step earlier than usual and give your mate a big welcome home. The point is to vary the routine and enhance even a small touching experience. Now, how do you discover your primary love language then? Well, there's three ways to discover it, according to Chapman anyway. First of all, what does your spouse do or fail to do that hurts you most deeply? The opposite of what hurts you most is probably your love language. So what is the thing that hurts you the most that your wife or your husband does? And you download the outline, just think about these things. You know, you're not going to probably figure it out right now on the spot. But think about that. What hurts me the most? Is it whenever I'm trying to talk to her and she's not paying attention? Or I'm sharing my deepest thoughts and she doesn't care? Or she never touches me. I just wish she would touch me. I wish she'd, you know, just be sweet to me or something. Or she never buys me anything. You know, she goes out shopping, she buys the kids stuff. She never buys me anything. Or what were some of the other ones? She never does anything for me. You know, she never picks up my clothes or whatever. You know, something like that. So think about that. If something really bothers you, chances are that's your primary love language and it's not being met. So that's the easy way to figure it out. What have you most often requested of your spouse? The thing that you have often requested is likely the thing that would make you feel most loved. So just think back. What are the things that you're always asking your spouse for? Or maybe you don't verbally ask, but you just think in your mind, "I really wish she would do this." That's your primary love language. In what way do you regularly express love to your spouse? Your method of expressing love may be an indication of the way that you feel loved. This is a really important one. What do you find yourself doing for your spouse? Like me, I've told you, if I upset my wife, my first inclination is to reach over and rub her arm or her leg or something. That's because my love language is physical touch. It's an easy way to figure it out. So if you're one that's always doing something for somebody to show them that you love them, and you're like that, then acts of service is your love language. If you're touching people, if your thing is when you go to comfort somebody and you give them a hug, you put your hands on them, physical touch. If you like to buy people a gift, if just when you're out and you think, "Oh, so-and-so would love this thing," and you buy it for them, gifts, that's your primary love language. So that's the ways that you can figure out what it is. Pay attention to your spouse's complaints to figure out what his or her language is. Chapman says the complaints of your spouse are the most powerful indicators of the primary love language. So just listen. Whatever she or he complains about, they're letting you know that that's their primary love language. My spouse's criticisms about my behavior provide me with the clearest clue to her primary love language. People tend to criticize their spouses most loudly in the area where they themselves have the deepest emotional need. Their criticism is an ineffective way of pleading for love. It's not effective to criticize and nag your spouse about what you would like them to do for you to feel loved. It's not effective, but it is a good indicator of what your primary love language is. So if your spouse is complaining to you and nagging to you about things, then pay attention and realize, these are the things that I need to do to make her feel loved. Even though your inclination is to say, "I hate to be nagged. I feel like I don't want to do it, even though I know what it is." But do it anyway. It'll pay you dividends. Now, if you're a man, don't assume that physical touch is your primary love language because you like sex. A lot of men make this mistake. They think, "I'm a guy. I like to have sex a lot," if you're married, that is. And therefore, physical touch must be my primary love language. But you don't want to make that mistake. And I'll tell you how you can figure out if it is actually your primary love language or if it's not. You see, men have a physical need for sexual release, which makes some of them conclude that this is their love language. But for men, it's not so much the emotional need, it's a physical need. You build up sperm and then it's got to be released, right? And it happens every few days. So that doesn't necessarily mean that that's your love language. So a man should ask himself, if my sexual needs were met, would other non-sexual touches make me feel loved? So think about that. If I'm getting all the sex that I want and getting a shoulder massage makes me feel loved, then that's probably your primary love language. If you like being touched, if you like giving hugs, things like that, that's probably your primary love language. Here's another way to do it. Figure out your secondary love language, figure out what that is, and then ask yourself, if my sexual needs were met and my spouse did not speak my secondary love language to me, would I still feel loved? If not, then what you thought was your secondary language is probably your primary. So if you're a man and you think, okay, physical touch is my primary, but my secondary is words of affirmation, then think, okay, if I'm getting all my sexual needs met and my wife was not affirming me, she was not telling me, oh, you did such a good job, oh, I love you, oh, I'm so appreciative of what you do, oh, you look great in that suit today, oh, you're so good with the kids, whatever. If she's not telling you those things and you're feeling like, I wish she would at least appreciate me, I wish she would compliment me once in a while, that's your primary love language. It's not physical touch. So answering these questions should help a man figure out if physical touch is his love language. Now, lastly, I'll leave you with a website and a homework assignment if you would like to do it. And if you don't, then don't do it. But it's www.5lovelanguages.com. And you can go there and you can take your love language test for free. And they'll ask you a series of questions and you answer those questions and then it will categorize them and it will show you what your primary and secondary love language is. And then have your spouse do the same thing, learn what each other's primary love language is, and then learn to speak those things, learn to do those things. And it's not going to come natural to you, but if you do it, you will experience a deeper love than you've probably experienced thus far. So thanks for listening today.